Today, on our Tech for Business podcast, we're joined by Todd, our COO and CISO, and Nate, our Director of Cybersecurity, to talk about the recent cyber attack on the city of St. Paul. What we know today, we're recording this August 6th. I'm just gonna read verbatim the verbiage that's on the St. Paul website, and I will make sure to link that. Friday, July 25th. There was a cybersecurity protection systems detected suspicious activity in the city's network. The alert triggered immediate response. They were working closely with state leaders, private cybersecurity experts, and their teams to quickly move and to investigate, assess, and contain the situation. This is all still ongoing at this point. And like I said, I will link the city's website below so you can read more of their formal information. But basically, there was an incident over the weekend, and we kind of heard about it Monday, Tuesday, and we're still sort of piecing all of these things together. Anything that you guys are seeing right away as cybersecurity professionals, anything that you're hearing, anything that's kind of coming down the line from this incident?
It's really early, as you mentioned. So
yeah,
details, we can kind of infer a bunch. And so as we're talking through this, just assume that Nate and I are kind of inferring some of the information. There is a little bit of information and we're kind of pulling the pieces together. The initial thing that I kind of wanted to point out is it's clear that the city of St. Paul actually did have a very strong security program in place, in my opinion. The fact that they had tools that were reporting and showing malicious activity happening on their network, and that they took action that was very proactive and were able to start to isolate their network, is pretty big. Most cities that we tend to work with do have some tools, but the actual overall maturity that we see, generally speaking, is not fully in place. So the fact that, and I'll be pretty blunt here, the fact that there is a security operations center seeing activity and saying we need to act now is unusual for the vast majority of the cities that we work with. So that's the big thing. I mean, and again, if I'm pointing it out, what that typically means is I think they alluded to having EDR in place, and that's great, but it potentially also included something like a SIM solution where they're seeing more activity happening. Somebody's monitoring going, hey, this is not right. And again, very proactively took steps, which to me says two things. A, they've got a program, and B, they also have an incident response plan because they actually implemented the response plan and started taking action right away.
Yeah. And to follow up on that with, you know, Todd's statements there was, we typically see that at the larger counties or cities, right? So it makes sense that St. Paul, being our state, you know, capital and everything like that, would likely have the IT resources to be able to support that. The vast majority of Minnesota cities do not.
Yeah.
And especially when it comes to things like who's responsible for the IT in a city, it's usually going to be your city administrator, who is typically a non-technical individual, may or may not, right? That's a kind of a broad assumption. And then there's also, you know, the ISSO, those that are responsible for some of the, you know, sensitive data. Like if you have like a police department, it's usually like your chief of police, right? Again, typically another non-technical individual. So to Todd's point, the fact that they have an IT team, a security operations center, does show some type of maturity of that IT environment.
I want to dive a little bit into mentioning that the city of St. Paul has these resources, which is great. But they did call in for external support that I would like to talk about this. You know, they called in the Minnesota National Guard, which as a layperson who is not highly technical, that kind of sets off red flags. You know, what's going on? How bad is this? Why did they call them in? Are they always called in? Can we talk a little bit about what we sort of know in broad terms about bringing in that external support?
I have to reach over. So if you're listening to this on a streaming platform, not watching, I apologize. I grabbed a picture off my desk here. My kids drew me a picture. It's of dad swinging on a rope against some black hat hackers in jail. So if you can see that, great. Go watch it on YouTube or something. That's how I envision the National Guard coming in. We're dropping from Chinook helicopters and we're going to go find the hackers. So I have to tell my kids I fight hackers at work to try and make the career day eventually interesting. But the National Guard, yeah, so this is they have their own cyber division. It was developed 8 years ago. this is the first time that it's been called in for additional resources from a city. So kind of setting some type of precedence. I don't have the full details of why, right? You know, but from some of the other, you know, research that I've been looking into is when you call in, Governor Walz issued the emergency response. What emergency response does is it technically unlocks additional resources that may not be available without additional red tape. And so it kind of unlocks that, you know, the red tape to say communication can flow more easily. Maybe if your internal resources aren't sufficient, you can start drawing from things like, you know, the Minnesota National Guard to be able to assist with that. But there is some type of precedent saying we've never had to do that before. Todd may be able to expand on that a little bit further, but this is not the first city in Minnesota that has experienced ransomware. So there, I don't know what to infer from that. But there's something.
One clarifying point, they, to our best of our knowledge, have not been ransomed. But the fact that they called them in, it's a great question. Why they did it, I don't know for sure. But I kind of mentioned this before, is they clearly have an incident response plan in case anybody's curious. You know, in the plainest language I can use is the equivalent is in case a fire break glass, right? So then they said, okay, now what do we do? And in that plan somewhere, they said, if it gets to XYZ, we pull in the National Guard. And so whatever was happening, it was definitely big enough that they reached that level of criticality and they pulled the trigger. But what that means, I don't know exactly. It could be they felt like what they were seeing, they didn't have the level of expertise. They didn't have the manpower, or as Nate mentioned, they just needed to be able to remove the cap on it. They have said that they've been working with the FBI too. Historically, when we've worked with the FBI, there are certain levels of, again, criticality is probably the easiest way to do it, but it's usually a dollar amount before they get extremely active. And because they weren't ransomed, or at least not to this point, it probably slowed things down. And this was a way, again, as Nate phrased it, remove the cap from what was happening. We are speculating to some degree. As Nate mentioned, this is not the first time that we've had security events in the city. In fact, over the weekend, North St. Paul, which is considered separate from the city of St. Paul, actually had a business email compromise as well. So are they related? Don't know, but things are happening on a pretty regular basis. I am going to go mildly off script. This is broadly speaking of, when we maybe get into this a little bit more, but municipalities, the government organizations, they are fairly heavy target. I believe they're ranked third behind finance and healthcare. But between 2018 and 2024, there was 525 individual ransomware attacks that were taken against them to the tune of over $1 billion. So again, is that what's happening in St. Paul? Not 100% sure, but it seems to be probably something like that. Some of the details that have come out is, I'm sure St. Paul will say it was in an abundance of caution, but they did very specific things like take payment processing offline. They've alerted citizens that, hey, we want to make sure you're not doing online payment, those types of things. You may be getting bills that are not legitimate. In fact, I think the latest update said, if you're getting a waste bill, that one is legitimate, but everything else, please ignore and we won't hold you to late fees. So again, just kind of speculating there, it seems like it was a pretty wide and broad attack, and the fact that they brought in the National Guard would seem to back that up.
The one thing I will call out as another success of St. Paul is that the emergency services remained online.
Yeah.
So the reason why I want to call that out is there may be counties or cities that are listening to this right now that have not fully segmented their police department. Huge red flag. It is something that you are required to do, but from our experience, again, there's typically non-technical individuals that are leading the IT of some of these. You have to segment and ensure that they are properly two separate networks. So in the event of some type of incident, whatever it may be, it cannot bleed over and impact your criminal justice information, right? And all of your emergency services, it should not be on the same network. That's very, very critical. And the reason why is, again, that impacts lives. You know, I don't know how to make it more blunt. I think it was back in 2018 or 2019, we saw the first case of a death associated by ransomware. And it was back in out in Germany. I think we've talked about that before. But there's been other hospitals and other places around, even Minnesota here. You know, I'm not going to go pick on certain hospitals, but there's one close in the Twin Cities that I have had family and friends that worked at, that they had ransomware and they had to start diverting ambulances around. In the critical minutes that you need to divert someone, that could be the difference of life and death. So kudos to St. Paul about keeping those networks segmented and operational. But for those that haven't done the full segmentation of those critical resources, start today.
Yeah, it's a great example. Oddly enough, the business email compromise that I mentioned for North St. Paul actually was on the police network, which is bad. But maybe that's a different podcast. But where Nate's going with it, that segmentation is just good security hygiene in general. But he highlighted why it's critical. It's not just something you should be thinking about. It is critical, especially for cities to do this. One other kind of expansion on that briefly is the reaction from the city of St. Paul. What they did is they essentially isolated those systems from the internet. So they still have the ability to, for all intents and purposes, pull the plug on the internet connectivity. Did they do that specifically? I don't know how they're addressing it, but they do have the capability of isolating the systems that are having problems. And whether that's through segmentation or some other security tool set, not sure. But the fact that you can potentially do that once you go down the segmentation process, it does allow you to do a much deeper isolation of assets as you get into it. So again, absolutely critical for cities and counties to be considering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I watched Mayor Carter speak a little bit on how he was trying to balance operational continuity and restoring the network, where you prioritize one and the other. And sometimes having, in part of the incident response, having the ability to go back to manual processes. We talk about automation, we talk about AI, yay, it's so great. But then when everything goes down, can you go back to paper and pencil? Can you still have that operations up and running if you don't have all of your technology? We're going to have a different podcast on incident response that we can go into details, but maybe we'll just touch a little bit on how do you balance keeping operations, restoring the network, and then also being able to function manually when you've moved so much to technology mm-hmm. and automation.
I'll start off with, it doesn't hurt to document critical processes and having some type of contingency plan. Mm-hmm. That's just good IR, incident response planning. I will also be transparent. Oftentimes there are no good alternatives, right? You still need data to flow. I think I've talked about this one in the past. Again, no customer names or anything like that. The first incident response ransomware engagement I've ever been called on, they were a warehouse company. And so they had a lot of inventory and people put in their orders, you know, either the website or by calling in. And then they were able to process that and, you know, ship them out. So in the event of that ransomware incident, yeah, they couldn't put in the orders right into the system and track it, but they were able to go in and say, yeah, let me see what you need, right? And they were taking down manual orders and everyone was moving around the warehouse to figure out, do we even have this in stock, and sticking like sticky notes on it saying purchased, right? Don't try and resell this, the next one.
Yeah.
I asked them, what's your tolerable downtime, right? They said, we could get by for about 2 weeks doing this, which is great. We were able to get in, help them out, restore them, get the network nice and clean and secure moving forward. But there are other organizations where if I'm down for 1 hour, that's costing me six figures, right? So, and it's all because it's so deeply integrated with technology. You know, I'll pick a big one, is e-commerce. I've seen customers and organizations that are heavy e-commerce. And when the website goes down, no one can put in an order. It's that critical.
Yeah. Hey, so ultimately, while this does fall into incident response, we're largely talking about business continuity. And that's true even if it isn't a cybersecurity attack. Sometimes things happen and you do need to potentially go back to pencil and paper, which really stinks. But one of the things you can kind of consider is trying to take payment methods when you don't have your typical stuff. So like credit cards, as an example, if your POS goes offline, could be very problematic. And then you get into all kinds of other things. But again, this is getting to the where I want to go with this is there should be a good plan for incident response. Ultimately, from my perspective, if you have a plan, it's better than nothing. And then you can refine it and get more and more detail on it. But as an example here is, as I'm taking credit card information potentially manually, once I process it, as part of your plan, you have to have the ability to dispose of that information in a meaningful way. And typically, if you don't have it written down or a checklist, those kind of steps tend to get lost and you're facing other problems long term. But Nate does bring up good points. It's kind of interesting to look at how the city of St. Paul is going through this. They are going through very clearly a step-by-step process. They have identified criticality. Their cloud apps are all back up and running. They've been opening up libraries and whatnot, but some things are not available. So some of the online things are, and as I mentioned earlier, their payment processing, they just said, we're pausing that until we can make sure this is clean. But, you know, some things, again, kind of inferring that's going on and they're still working through is the very first thing they did, and this is good practice in your incident response plan as well, is we want you to update your password across all of your business or city accounts, but we want you to do that personally too. And I want to bring this up just briefly because we know what passwords are like, and we've talked about passwords endlessly, but I'm going to hammer it home one more time is people reuse passwords. So if you've used it at the city one time or another, you've almost certainly used it in your personal life as well. It's just the way people are. So good hygiene, make sure it's in your response plan. Let's update passwords, make sure that's going on, or get rid of them entirely.
This is one where I also wanted to touch on the incident response plan is a communication response plan. So you can actually see this observed if you go rewatch the initial, you know, kind of news release with, you know, the mayor and St. Paul's CISO, you know, doing their initial communication out to the news media. When they start touching on a topic where they are not authorized to fully speak on behalf of it, as you're watching it, you'll see them trying to process, how do I want to respond to it? And if they are about to say something, you know, that they shouldn't necessarily, or, you know, legal hasn't necessarily approved of yet, you'll see it. The other person slip in and say, hey, I'll answer that. And then they give a washed answer, kind of that political answer, right? And they're helping each other stay within the guidelines of legal recommendations. So, and this is something where everyone wants to be helpful, which is also the detriment sometimes, because someone can take that and twist it and it's maybe non-factual, right? Or I usually tell people, I do not provide any opinions. I only provide attestations, right? And so until there is concrete evidence, I have no update for you. And that is super critical when it comes to incident response. Everyone wants the update today. It just doesn't happen, right? And so go rewatch it. You'll see that observed pretty heavily. But what they're doing is good incident response communication planning. There is a lot of bad communication planning. If you go watch other ones or, you know, other organizations and how they approach it, but communication will make or break your security incident.
Yeah, I mean, I won't dig too far into it, but there are certain personalities that are very much, I want to help. I want to be there. I'll use a salesperson as an example. Salespeople are there to give information. And so they always want to have the latest and greatest information, and they want to be able to put somebody's concerns to ease. And so you just got to be careful when you're making your communication plans, as an example of maybe those people just need to know, here's the plan, go to the website, there's the information. We've talked about it with other events in the past too, but those people should be under consideration. They're not trying to do anything malicious. They just are naturally interested in sharing information because that's who they are. And you just got to make sure that they stay within the boundaries of where they need to be in certain types of communication put pieces as well.
Yeah. And I imagine that sometimes, you know, it's hard to communicate because you want people to know, or you want that trust to be flowing between customer or, you know, your people of your city. Yes, you want that reassurance, but there's still this investigation going on. So you don't have the information, or you need to keep things private because of X, Y, and Z happening in the background as well, you know, which is it's a hard line to walk. You know, I can only imagine what that planning looks like and how it kind of changes as you actually go through it. I'm interested, again, we don't know, but sort of afterwards, how long does this repair take? What is the financial burden that could potentially be for a city versus if they had put prevention steps in place? What does that look like? And we're going to talk broad terms because there's no way to know specifically for the city of St. Paul.
Right. You and I were on the same wavelength here because I was just thinking about transitioning to the same topic.
Yeah.
Todd, did you have anything you want to start with?
Yeah, I mean, it does vary. Typically, the attackers are ridiculously savvy when it comes to the financial aspect of it. And by that, I mean, when they build the ransoms, they have a very good idea of the range that they want to fall into, of how much money they're going to try to extort, typically. However, even when that's true, there are the ancillary costs that go into it. So I'll use an example of, again, St. Paul's not the first one. The city of Atlanta, Georgia was attacked several years ago. And I believe the financial number they used for that recovery was somewhere in the range of $17 million. And so where I was going is there is all kinds of stuff on the back end that is potentially causing you to run into additional costs, bringing in the National Guard as an example, bringing in third-party security experts, the fact that you're offline, the restoration process, the inability to take incoming income. So like I said, if St. Paul has pulled all their payments off, there basically is no income that the city is typically paying, usually getting over the course of a month. It's now delayed. I mean, we're almost at a week. So we're at a week now. It'd probably be, generally speaking, we see recoveries, even when they're fast, they tend to be 2 weeks. So cities being bigger, I would guess it'll take longer. But the answer is, yes, it's very wide ranging. It could be a couple hundred thousand. You could see it could be several million dollars as well.
Yep. Yeah. Usually, if you go take a look at statistics, the average downtime is 2 weeks, right? And we actually see that right now, right? So St. Paul has been down for about 2 weeks. And so I've personally helped lead 30 plus ransomware engagements at this point. And that completely holds true. The best responses, you know, the fastest one I've done was 2 hours, right? Is customers down, restore, based off of, you know, virtualized backups, they're up and running. Customers don't know the difference by the time that they walk in the front door. I've also had customers that are down for 3+ weeks due to multiple failures along the way. And it's very impactful to the business. So St. Paul, again, appears to be running the critical services. They're opening up things like libraries, which you would classify as less critical, right? Payment processing, that's something that is critical, but they're still going to get their money when it does reopen, right? They did say that with the waste, is you still have to pay your bills, but at least they're deferring late fees, you know, along the way as well right now. So they are doing the right thing. A little bit before this podcast, I did some research as well. So to Todd's point, they are not the first city in the United States that's been hit, or, you know, bigger metropolitan area. So I'm just looking at my other screen here. Baltimore, Maryland, Atlanta, Georgia, Dallas, Texas, New Orleans, Louisiana, Knoxville, Tennessee, now St. Paul. There's been some other ones as well. But taking a look at these, you know, the smallest total impact was Knoxville, Tennessee. Theirs was $2.5 million. The largest one was Baltimore, Maryland at $18.2 million. And then the total duration from those was anywhere between 14 to 90 days. So Maryland, they were the most expensive. They were also down for 90 days. The quickest one was actually New Orleans. Theirs was still $8.6 million. They were down for 2 weeks. But when you take this and break it down per capita of the citizens in there, it's ranging. The cheapest one was Dallas, Texas, at about $6 per resident. The most expensive was $31 per resident. So if you are trying to, let me actually backtrack one step there. You know, a lot of the counties and cities in Minnesota are part of a larger league of counties and, you know, that league of cities that have some type of insurance fund, right? That, it, by default, has a $250,000 cap. If you answer some of the common, you know, insurance questions like, do you do regular security training? It ups it to $500,000. $500,000 is significantly less than the multi-millions that we're talking about here today. And so cities, unless you're seeking like third-party insurance, you know, coverage, they typically will self-fund themselves. So you have to incorporate, how much do we plan for a potential security incident in the future, right? Well, what do we start budgeting for in some type of cost analysis? Well, if you take a look at the per capita of these major incidents, you can calculate kind of the likelihood of this based off of your security tools. I would say the average from what I'm seeing of these, I didn't do the math, I should have, you know, count somewhere around $20 per resident in your city, right? So either self-fund it and just ride out the payment when it does happen, or that's potentially what you start using when you start trying to go to the city council for a budget for your new security tools to better protect yourself.
Yeah, we're circling back and just kind of reiterating some of the numbers that Nate just mentioned, as Ariel specifically asked, what does a downtime typically look like? So the fastest recovery was 14 days. So while we said the average is 2 weeks, the fastest for a city that size has been 2 weeks. The city of Baltimore was like 90 days.
90 days.
And Minnesota, St. Paul just extended the state of emergency for 90 days. So I have to imagine it's significant, right? I mean, we've talked about it enough already. We have to say this was a pretty significant deal. And while they probably dodged a bullet, it's still an extreme hindrance to the city itself. You know, we're probably hinting at this too. And it seems like it's the next question is, does it make sense to get into the preventative versus reactionary? Because Nate just mentioned it is, now I'm talking to the city council and I'm talking about fundings and whatnot, whether it's insurance or other. You do get into a conversation, and this is where we typically see that most cities struggle, is most of them have some sort of regulation that has been implemented that says you must have endpoint detection or response. We know in the state of Minnesota, it's absolutely required, to the point where the state actually went out and made a rather large purchase of a tool set that they've extended to the cities. I will tell you that the vast majority of the small cities that we work with, it's just the tool. There is no backing security operations piece. And again, most of those decisions were made because I've got the tool and that's just what I was able to get approved. However, if I just have the tool and I don't have anybody looking at it, you're not going to be in a situation where the city of St. Paul is going, I see something going on, turn it off. Which means you're looking at a really big, bad, I was going to say day, but we just talked about it. You're looking at a bad month, right? Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to quick mention, this week, our security team, we're helping a company that called in for assistance. They had the leading class EDR solutions. Threat actor was knocking on the door, generating hundreds of alerts for 12 hours before the network was encrypted. So to Todd's point, they had 12 hours to try and isolate devices and lock things down, but there was no one looking at it overnight. And so that's the criticality of, you need someone actually looking at the logs.
Right. So where I'm going with this is as we get into preventative, the tools are wonderful, but Nate's mentioned this in the past too, is it's not just a tool. You need the people, the process, and the tools. You can't just get a tool and go, good, I got it. I checked the box. I'm ready to go. And unfortunately, I don't know if it's a communication thing when you go to the city council that it just doesn't get through. But if you're not communicating the full picture of why I need all of it together, again, unfortunately, you're looking at a bad month, and we've said it many times, and it's pretty cliche at this point. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and you can see it. Even for an organization that looks like they have their stuff together, like the city of St. Paul appeared to, they're still a target.
Yeah. We've talked preventative tools and proactive steps in the past. To ask it in a different way, if you had an unlimited budget, what is the first thing or one thing you would add? Mm-hmm. And since we're talking about the city of St. Paul, maybe consider it in terms of a city. What is that one thing?
Since money's not an issue, I'm going to do two. I'm sorry. I just made a post online about this as well, was eliminating your VPN. It is by far the number one attack vector we see when it comes to major security incidents like ransomware, right? Is we've had the traditional VPNs, we've put multi-factor into them, and you know, they either people are still accepting the multi-factor prompts, getting people in, or there's critical zero-day vulnerabilities. More to come on another podcast with that one. We will probably do another one in like 2 days. But so getting rid of the VPNs though, right, is typically once you get into that VPN, you have full access to the network. You have to get rid of those VPNs in favor of a traditional zero trust network access or ZTNA solution. I'm sure we'll have about 50 show notes with that. The other thing is going to be your application allow listing. This is something that has historically been a major challenge to get implemented. There are now tools, and you know, CIT is a major partner of this, is I'll pick on ThreatLocker. We've done a ThreatLocker podcast as well, is getting into the point where no new software can run in your environment without explicit review and approval. It sounds complicated and impactful. They've made it extremely easy to be able to do that and maintain it. Again, we help plenty of cities and counties with that today. But ransomware does not happen in those cases, right? You would have to get in and see, hey, someone's actively trying to kick off all the reverse shells or remote connections in your environment. Denied, right, by default. They're trying to install new ransomware or their attack tools to be able to further their attack. Denied by default, right? It just doesn't happen. So if you can eliminate the VPN, there is no initial access. That's common, at least against the public internet. And then even if someone does get in, because you have that deny by default stance, you can't just hop in and run malicious software. It just doesn't happen. So since CIT has rolled that out for our customers, we don't see security incidents like this against our customers, right? The customers that we do incident response for these days are the ones that are still running VPN, and even if they have the best EDR solutions, like the one that we're helping out this week, they still got impacted. And if they had just focused on those two tools, the impact would have been significantly less. Sorry, I'm going to get off my high horse.
Oh, I mean, you've got great points, and I wanted to cheat, but just to kind of express on why Nate's harping on default deny is, if you look at the way that Microsoft and to a lesser degree other operating systems work, they were designed to be default allow. And the reason why they were denied, set up that way, and again, if you look at how Windows installs, is you basically start with an admin account, and for good reasons, you need to be able to set it up. But it was designed to get rid of the friction, right? I don't want to make it inconvenient for Joe User. And if Joe User is having a problem, we'll just allow it. That makes things much easier. And so that's why it's important to look at transitioning the mindset from I'll just make it easy to not make it easy for the bad guys, right? So there are certain things that I kind of go, these are non-negotiables. You absolutely have to have them. And I think they're low cost. My cheating was going to say, get rid of your technical debt. So to me, that looks like that traditional stuff that Microsoft did, you know, Active Directory, that's well over 25 years old, VPN connections, well over 25 years old. So I feel like I'm cheating, but where I was originally going is I think you still need to do your end user training, and you absolutely still need EDR, but you need it with a SOC. You can't just get by with the tool. So I'm with Nate. I mean, if you've been paying attention to our podcasts, we were pretty adamant back in January when we did what are the trends for 25. We said, if there's one thing you do in 2025, it's get rid of your VPN. And he just said he was on the soapbox. I'll jump up on it and I'll jump up and down on that soapbox. If you're still using VPN, it's time to get rid of it. And in the week of August 6th, it is a massive problem where Nate said, we'll talk about it in another podcast, but VPNs are being exploited heavily this year. Get rid of that thing. You have to get rid of it. It's not optional any longer. So I remember we did this with EDR probably 4 or 5 years ago. We're doing it on VPN. You got to get rid of that thing.
Mic drop.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining CIT's podcast where Nate and Todd are just jumping up and down on soapboxes. We're fired up today. both.
I love it. That's a great place to end. I'll make sure to have all our resources and our million Eliminate VPN podcasts that we've done in the past. Thanks so much, Todd and Nate, for joining us. And we'll jump on the soapbox on a different day. Thanks.
See you Friday.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed this topic, please let us know. Like, subscribe, or reach out to us at info@cit-net.com or head out to our website, cit-net.com/podcast. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode.